There will be just about one little thought in the last lesson, and I don't think I'm going to take a lot of time there to go into that. But I have my lesson here, so you can take it from me on the first part of it. This is the historical part of the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. However, when we get down to verse 36, we enter into the prophetical part. But most of what we're going to talk about this morning will be a lot about Antiochus Epiphanes. He was one of the most wicked Assyrian rulers that ever lived in the history of the world. He was certainly not the kind of fellow that we'd like to even think about or say very much about. So I want us, first of all, to begin here at verse 21 of this 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 11, verse 21. From verse 21 down through verse 23, we have an account of the rise of Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. I call him Antiochus the Fourth because Epiphanes is a name added to him, like. It means great man and the like, but they usually changed that a little bit and made him the madman, because he did act more like a madman than he did a sane man. So that being the case, we'll see more about that as it goes further here. Now, let's look at verse 21 that tells about how that he's going to rise to power and some of his activities. And we may just go all the way down through about verse 23 there. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. That simply means he's going to take it by force. It does not belong to him by right. But he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arm of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Now let's go back over that and try to bring the historical fulfillment out, as we have very briefly stated here in our lesson. This king of the north that's here under consideration is Antiochus Epiphanes. He was the youngest son of Antiochus the Great, who is well known in history. He was unscrupulous, cruel, and of a very savage nature. That's why I said he was given the nickname by some people of his own time and historians, Antiochus the Madman, because he acted more like a madman than anything else. But now, do not get the idea that he lacked courage or ability. He was a man of considerable ability, and he was a man of great courage, because he often would attack armies far greater in size than his. So he was not without courage, but he was without a lot of good sense sometimes. As we pointed out when we read verse 21 there, to whom they shall give the honor of the kingdom. Not give the honor. Note the word not there. Shall not. That means he'll take it by seizure. He did not come into the kingdom by an honorable fashion at all. He was a usurper, is what we call him. The throne belonged to Demetrius Soter. He was the youngest son of Seleucus Philopater. Demetrius was at this time a hostage in the city of Rome. And of course, by slippery actions and with the help of some other people there, Antiochus came to power. He took over the kingdom by usurpation, and that's how he obtained it. And then after that, with the help of even some that had formerly been his enemies, he swept away the Egyptians in a mighty conquest in 170 B.C. and then deposed the Jewish high priest, Onias. And he was the one there under consideration about stand up there against the prince of the covenant. That prince of the covenant is the high priest. And then his informal alliance with King Eumenes and his brother Attalus is what's under consideration there in verse 23. And of course, he persuaded the Romans to recognize him. In that particular day, the Roman government was the greatest empire in the world. And if you could have the recognition of Rome, it was about like having the recognition today of either Russia or the United States. It meant a great deal. So Antiochus, ruling only one of the small, formerly provinces of the Roman Empire, wanted to have all of the good standing that he could possibly have. So in order to do that, what did he do? Well, he got Rome to recognize him. He got to be a good fellow there with his standing with Rome. Now, he grows in power as we go down through verse 24 to 26. We're not going to take a lot of time on this because it's just history, but we do want to bring out as much as we can about it. Let's look first at verse 25. Or rather, verse 24, I'm sorry. And he shall enter peaceably even unto the fattest places of the provinces. And he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey, and spoil, and riches. Yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. Now, looking into some of the history that this fulfills, Antiochus scattered the spoils of his conquest among his friends. That was not ordinarily done in the case of kings. They would keep the conquest, keep the booty for themselves, but he did otherwise. The stronghold of Egypt was Pelusia, Naucratis, and Memphis, which he occupied, but he failed to take Alexandria, which was the chief city of Egypt in that day. He was finally checked by the Romans because they thought he was going too far. Perhaps they looked upon him as a rival, and so they put him in his place. And then there are several expeditions that he made against Egypt and defeated the Egyptians in most of those, and that's what we have in verse 25. And he shall stir up for his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. Now, always remember that the king of the south is Egypt, which lies south of Syria. Does today, did then. There's been no change in the geographical location of those countries since the days of Daniel. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Actually, a lot of Egypt's rulers engaged there in battles with Antiochus. Ptolemy Philometor was primarily the one that he always had to battle with. That man ruled from 181 to 145 B.C. And Ptolemy Philometor was one of the sons of Cleopatra, and also was a nephew of Antiochus Epiphanes. So he was at war with his nephew. That's what I'm telling you. I suppose you could say that the family must not have got along too well, because they were a part of two rival kingdoms. And then let's look into verse 26. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat. That's people that eat at the king's table. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. And of course, that means nothing more than that he would be supported by those that had supported the king of Egypt, that is supposed to have been his aides, his allies, would turn out to be his enemies, and they would finally fight against him. And the reference is to the trusted counselors that ate at the king's table. They turned out to be his worst enemies, and went into an alliance with Antiochus, which of course brought about the defeat of Ptolemy Philometor. And so his army shall be overflowing in size, but still many of its number shall fall down dead. And that's what it said, many shall fall down slain, verse 26. Now we go on down to the 27th and 28th verse that we're going to read and quickly give the historical background of. And both these kings' hearts, now what you're talking about, the king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of the south, Ptolemy Philometor, and both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, In other words, one of them going to try to put it over on the other one. And they shall speak lies at one table. Sounds like modern day peace treaties, doesn't it? Modern day alliances. You know, Paul said in the last days there'd be covenant breakers. Breakers of peace treaties is what that really means. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Now this has reference, of course, to the struggle between Syria and Egypt that led to various agreements, none of which were kept on the part of either party. They would lie at the peace table, common custom in our modern day. Antiochus returned from Egypt with great riches and began to manifest his hatred toward the Jews. That's what we have there in verse 28. He shall return into his own land, that is, he'll go back to Syria, with great riches, taking a lot of spoils of war, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant. That simply means the people who believe in the Holy Covenant and who are in a covenant relation with God, the Israelites. And so his heart will be against the Holy Covenant, the Israelites, the people of the covenant. And he shall do exploits, that is, wage war, engage in a military campaign against them. And all of this is going to happen at the time that he's returning to his own land. Now, to give further details of that, let me give you some history there. Antiochus heard, due to a false report of his death, that Jason, now that's a Jew who is in Jerusalem in Palestine, who had been deprived of the high priest's office. Now, you know who deprived him, don't you? Antiochus. Had attacked Jerusalem to recover his office. And so far as I know, that was true, he had. Considering this a revolt of the Jews, not of one man, but the whole nation, see. He attacked Jerusalem and slew 40,000 of the inhabitants. So many slaves and plundered the temple. And you can imagine how that incurred the wrath of the Jewish people. To have their place of worship plundered. Well, it would be about like if we had our church building plundered. It would be about like if somebody plundered the Mormon temple or plundered the Mosque of Omar that the Muslims believe in, or some other important place where people have the center of their religious activities. So it was a terrible thing that happened there, but that's not the end. That's only the beginning of what Antiochus is going to do. So you see what he did. He went down to Egypt. He fought a war. Then he took all the spoils down there from Ptolemy Philometor. He headed back home. He heard about this revolt, and so he attacked the Jews on the way back home to Syria, to the north, his homeland. He wasn't through with them yet, though. He really means to make a sharp end of them in time to come. And that's what we have as we go on down here in verse 29 to 31. We see how that he was opposed by the Romans. It seemed that the Ptolemies could never keep him in check. That the only people that could put him in his place was the mighty Romans. The world in that day feared the legions of Rome. They were the best trained soldiers in the world. They were very numerous soldiers. And they knew no fear in battle. And so evidently Antiochus had rather not tangle with the Romans. He would like to have their recognition. He wanted to stay on the good side of them. And when they attacked him, he got his britches whipped every time. And so he tried to stay out of trouble with the Romans. But he gets into trouble with them again. Now let's go and look there at the 29th verse. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south. That's another invasion of Egypt. But he shall not be as the former or as the latter. In other words, this time he's not going to win. He's going to be defeated. Well, Antiochus in 168 B.C. led his troops to Egypt in order to subjugate the two brothers, Ptolemy Philometor and Ptolemy Phicon. The brothers appealed to Rome. And that's why that it didn't work out so well for Antiochus in that battle. Then let's read the 30th verse. For the ships of Chittim, that's modern day Cyprus, shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Take his spite out on the Jews again. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. So he's going to have some help there out of some apostate Jews, which is a terrible thing. One enemy within is worse than 10,000 foes without. Any military strategist knows that to be so. So Antiochus was met near Alexandria by a Roman consul, Gaius Popilius Laenas, who demanded that he leave Egypt immediately. Gaius was backed by a Roman fleet in the bay that came from Chittim, or from the island of Cyprus, as we know it today. Well, Antiochus, of course, would not tackle the mighty Romans. He knew he'd met his match. There wasn't but one thing to do. That is, take spite out on the Jews and not bother the other people for a while. Because, after all, the Romans didn't care much for the Jews either. So that's what we have in verse 30 and 31. And the arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. So again, Antiochus is taking out his wrath on the Jews. He will not tackle the mighty Romans, but he's not afraid of the Jews. And if he can't whip the Romans, then he'll whip the Jews. That'll be his second choice. And so that's what he did there in verse 30 and 31. He polluted the holy altar by offering a sow. Now bear in mind that the law of the Jewish people did not even permit a man to own swine, let alone to eat them. And so about the height of desecration of a holy place would have been to offer a sow upon the altar in the Jewish temple. That would be the lowest form of insult this man could engage in. No wonder they called him Antiochus the madman. And of course, it set off a reaction on the part of the Jewish people that finally led almost to the end of Antiochus. He pushed him too far. There's something that people learn in political strategy. You can push people too far. The whole history of the world is replete with people that have been pushed too far. Why was there a French Revolution? Too many people got their head cut off on the guillotine. They got tired of it. Why were there revolutions throughout the world? Because people had been oppressed and they'd been pushed too far. So don't ever push people too far. They'll react violently. They'll react with an enthusiasm that's hard to put down. If you want to really have a fight on your hands, you tackle a man on his home base and you insult his religion and you're going to be in trouble. And that's what Antiochus did. And to his sorrow, he's going to find it out. So he wouldn't let them sacrifice. He said, you can't bring any more lambs. You're not going to offer them on the altar. That's all over with. All of this Jewish worship is going to stop. And I know from history he told them that they had to worship the gods of Greeks, the gods, plural, they only believed in one. And here he tells them that they've got to worship the gods of the Greeks. Well, first of all, they didn't believe in the gods of the Greeks. Secondly, they didn't believe in many gods. They believed in one God, and there was no way they were going to do that. No way. And so they couldn't offer the daily sacrifice. And what he did, he erected in the holy place the image of Zeus Olympus, which was the chief god of the Greeks. So they put up an image there of Zeus and said, now you fellows come in the temple, all right, and worship, but don't you worship Jehovah. You worship Zeus while you're here. And of course, they would not commit that act of sacrilege. That was the same bit of information we had back in Daniel chapter 8, verse 23 to 25. And then in verse 32 to 35, we see how that he's going to persecute the nation of Israel. Not only has he spoiled the nation, not only has he had a number of military campaigns against him, but worse than any of that, he's going to keep up that harassment, that persecution from time to time. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. So some of them will concur with Antiochus to try to save their skin. Others will say he's pushed us too far and we're going to fight him to the death. And that's really what we have presented there in that verse. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. So there will be religious instruction go forth. Yet they shall fall by the swords and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Many days. Look at that. Now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. Now we're going to look back over some of this, because he's describing here not only the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, which was going on at the time this prophecy is under consideration, but he goes all the way to the end of the 490 years. The many days here goes all the way to the end of the 490 years, days for a year. Now, the period between Antiochus and the Messiah, the prince, is what's under consideration here. He's not just describing the days of Antiochus. He's describing a whole series of events that'll go on for century upon century, you see. And I wish sometime, if you have the book of Clarence Larkin's on Daniel, that you'd read those two pages there. He gives a lot of information that we do not have the time to give here in this lesson. But I believe that he's taking in here all of the period of time that we call the church age or the time of the Gentiles. The whole period of time. We're living in it now, the latter end of it. The great parenthesis, the great gap between the 69th week and the 70th week. And what all is going to happen during that time is described right there, especially I note in verse 33 and 34. You have a remnant, you have a conservative element of Judaism that will stand up for the faith. On the other hand, you have some apostates that will go along with the Gentile world powers and go against their own people. That's been going on for hundreds of years so far as the Jews are concerned. Well, the Romans would destroy Jerusalem in A.D. 70. We learned that back in chapter 9 in verse 27. There's also a description of that destruction in Luke 21 and 24. And it greatly compares with what we have there. It says here in verse 33, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, by spoil many days. Now look over here in Luke how the language is so very near the same. There in Luke 21 and 24, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. It says they'll fall by the sword. They'll be taken away captive. That's exactly what we have in the description here in Daniel. So he describes there the great dispersion of Israel and all the events that will follow upon that. But you say, well, what did he mean there when he said some will be tried and purified? A lot of people like to apply that to the members of the Lord's church and say that that's the church in the tribulation. And during the time of the tribulation, they're going to be purged and purified. A number of problems to that idea. First of all, there is no church in the Old Testament. Number two, the context here does not concern anybody but Daniel's people, the Jews. To put any Gentiles into this context that concerns the Jews would be absolutely ridiculous. So the reference here is not to the church. There is no church in the Old Testament. There is no church in the book of Daniel or anywhere in the Old Testament. The reference is to Daniel's people that will suffer at the hands of wicked rulers of the sort as was Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of Syria. So now how will God, though, purge him? By suffering. God has often purged his people by suffering. Sometimes we pray that we might live a better life for the Lord. Well, you can. He'll probably purge you either by chastisement or by suffering. Because one or two of those ways is the way that God straightens his people out, as we term it. By suffering, by chastisement, maybe sometime by oral rebuke, as the prophets would come and rebuke people in the days of the Old Testament. And then let's look at that phrase there, time of the end. It occurs quite often in the book of Daniel. And I believe that it always refers to the time of the end before Jesus comes back to set up the kingdom. It certainly does here. We'll see later in this chapter in verse 40 that it does, and still again in chapter 12, verse 4 and 9, the same thing. So the phrase, the time of the end, regularly signifies the final end time. That is, the end of the times of the Gentiles, the end of Jewish oppression. That's what it means. Now, the time of Antiochus Epiphanes could not be called a time of the end. What time ended? There was no time that ended when that old man died. Time went right on. You say, well, the suffering of the Jewish people ended. No, not very much. You just had other fellows to come, the Ptolemies and the kings of Syria. They fought one another and used Palestine as a battleground for centuries there. So there's nothing that ended when Antiochus died, other than one madman died and another came to take his place. That's about all took place. So it was not the end time. It wasn't the time when the kingdom was set up. It wasn't the time when the Messiah came and all of that. It didn't refer to that at all. So the meaning is that the refinement of the Jews would continue all the way to the Great Tribulation and the Antichrist. They would go on being purged and purified. Look how they've suffered as a people. Look at the Holocaust. Look at the Spanish Inquisitions back during the Dark Ages. Look at their Egyptian bondage in the Old Testament, in the book of Exodus. We read all about that. And look at how that they suffered at the hands of Gentile nations throughout the time of the United Kingdom of Israel. Even in the days of Solomon and David and all the other kings of Judah and Israel. So it certainly has been, as the Bible here predicted, they have greatly, greatly been tried as a people. They have been exploited. They've been robbed. They've been spoiled. They have many times fallen down in death, but as a race of people, they have never been exterminated. They cannot. Because Jesus said that that race would not perish until He comes again. So don't get the idea you're going to exterminate the Jews, because the Lord's already guaranteed they're going to be here as a nation when He comes back. Because a part of that nation will look upon the one that they pierced and weep for it. So that's an eternal nation. You couldn't destroy it even if you tried. You say, well, a lot of people tried. The Spanish Inquisitioners tried, yes. But how did they come out? Well, they're gone. But the Jews are still here. Hitler tried his hand at it, but Hitler's not here anymore, and the Jews still are. And on we could go. Haman tried to exterminate the Jews. Haman's dead, but the Jews are still here. The Romans even tried to exterminate the Jews, but the Roman Empire's no more. But the Jews are still here. So you can't get rid of them. God said they were going to be here. Now, they're going to be robbed and spoiled by the Gentiles. They're going to be captives. One of the reasons why that they're courted so much in nations is because they got so much money. Everybody wants to get a Jew into his country that he might have some of his money. I go far enough to say that if the Jews took all of their money out of our banks, we'd be broke. You may not know that, but it's so. Furthermore, if they took all of their money out of the banks of the world would be broke. That is, they'd be to the point that they would have very little left. And the banks would not be able to honor their contracts and to make good their long-term loans and the like. The Jews have a great deal of money. That's not accidental. God promised them material prosperity. And they've had it. They've had it. Wherever you find a Jew, in about 99 9/10 of the time, you'll find that he's a very prosperous man. All the Jews that I've ever known have been very prosperous people. Sometime back when we visited a Jewish synagogue up here in Portsmouth, I got the impression as I sat there in that congregation there wasn't a poor man in the house. Because of the type of jewelry they had on, the type of clothing they had on, the type of automobiles that were parked outside, they either were very well to do or very deeply in debt, because they did not seem to be in a pinch, as the old saying goes. And so I commented to the brethren as we were coming back home. I said, it may very well be that we have just sat down in one of the most wealthy churches we've ever been to in our life. If you want to call it a church, they don't call it that. They call it a synagogue, but that's a church to them as they look upon it. So God promised them material prosperity. I'm not saying that he approved of all the schemes they sometimes concoct in order to get well, but I'm saying that God did promise them that, and nobody can deprive them of it. God told their great-grandfather Abraham, "I will bless you." And Abraham was one of the richest men in his day. Jacob was also a wealthy man. Isaac and the Israelites, they were very wealthy people because they even spoiled the Egyptians when they became a nation. They got all of the gold and silver there of Egypt as they made the Exodus. And that was the means there of getting them off to a good start from the financial standpoint when they came to their land of Canaan. We're going to spend the rest of the time just looking at verse 36. This is the Antichrist. "And the king shall do according to his will." And please note that it says the king. It's not called Antiochus king but one time in this so far. He was really not much of a king by anybody's standards. Caesar was a great king of that day. But here is a mighty king. "And the king shall do according to his will." That couldn't be Antiochus, because Antiochus couldn't do anything with the Romans. What he wanted to do to them, he couldn't succeed at. So it couldn't be Antiochus. The king, the definite article, is in the Hebrew as well as our English version. "And the king shall do according to his will. And he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done." There's a great deal in that verse, and we shall not perhaps bring it all out. This is Antichrist, the king of the 70th week of Daniel, the king of the end time, the last Gentile world ruler that will ever exist in this world is the willful king of Daniel 11:36. The world today is awaiting his emergency into history. That he may already be born and already be a man, I do not doubt, though I have no proof from the Bible of that. I do not doubt, based on what I know about the end time prophecies, but what the Antichrist is alive, that he is already a man and not a little child. I'll just give you that to go home and think about. Now, a lot of people say this all had reference to Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes was never able to do all that he wanted to do. There never has been any earthly ruler to a large degree that could do that. Here's one, though, that will, because he'll have satanic power to accomplish all that he wants to do, more than any other ruler has ever had. Of course, we got a lot of ideas among various people here. We got some, the idea of some of the rabbis, the rabbins say, especially Aben Ezra, that this means Constantine the Great. Well, I find nothing but indicate that to me. Horatio and Calvin say that it refers not to a man but to the Roman Empire. That idea is ridiculous. Philip Morrow, who was a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States and wrote a book about the book of Daniel, said that it's Herod the Great. I have read that book, but for the life of me, I cannot see how the man comes up with the idea that it was Herod the Great. To be a man as intelligent as I know he was, he sure didn't show it in that section of the book. That's all I'm going to say. Now, Jerome, Theodoret, Luther, and others said that it referred to the New Testament Antichrist, and that's what I believe it has reference to. And of course, those men lived even further back than some of the others that I mentioned there. Now let's see if we can't identify the king. Not a king, the king. Now why would the definite article be used? Because it is referring to a king that Daniel has already seen. The little horn in chapter 7 and verse 8. Also in verse 24 he's mentioned. He's the king of fierce countenance in chapter 8 in verse 23. He is the desolator of Daniel 9 and 27. So there's no need for Daniel just coming out and saying, "Now this is the Antichrist." He has three chapters before talked about this king. And so he's just telling us more about him now. The king of fierce countenance. And so this is the little horn, the king of fierce countenance, the desolator, who has already been mentioned before in this book and great details related concerning him. Now let's look at the description of this king. Now I will prove by New Testament scripture as well as old that he is indeed the final Antichrist, the man of sin, the son of perdition, that exalts himself above all that is called God. First, I note that he is a willful king. Do according to his will. As I said, that won't fit Antiochus very well. Secondly, then, I note that he's a self-exalting king. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god. I don't know how a fellow could exalt himself any more than to say that he was greater than God. I'll tell you again, this can't be Antiochus. Now, Antiochus was a very proud man. I concede that. He was a very arrogant man that thought he was almost as good as God, no doubt. But Antiochus never said he was God, so far as I have any record. Furthermore, he always, throughout his life, worshipped the gods of the Greeks that he tried to get the Jews to worship under penalty of death. But now this man doesn't worship any god. It's not Antiochus. It can't be. It won't fit the facts of history. But it does fit the facts about the final Antichrist. All right, he's going to magnify himself above God. Now let's let Paul tell us about the New Testament Antichrist. You'll find that he's the Old Testament little horn. In 2 Thessalonians, note the description there in verse 4 of chapter 2. Speaking about the son of perdition, the man of sin in verse 3 before. Who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. So that he is God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Antiochus was already dead when Paul wrote that. As a matter of fact, he'd been dead probably 100 years or more, maybe nearly 200 years. So he's not talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. He's talking about the man of sin, the final Antichrist, that's going to exalt himself above all the gods. Antiochus never did that. You cannot prove by history that he ever did that. This is a reference to the Antichrist. Now, he's going to speak astonishing, unbelievable things against God. Antiochus did not so much attack God as he did the people of the Holy Covenant. Again, I show that it will not square with the facts of history there. He shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods. The God of gods is the Lord God that we worship. And so he's going to speak against God. Well, what did Daniel say the little horn would do? Look back in chapter 7 at verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand, until the time and times and the dividing of time. 3.5 years. We already pointed out what that means. We'll just mention that in passing. And that's exactly the same that's said about the New Testament Antichrist. This time, look in the book of Revelation, chapter 13, at verse 5. It is a description of the same man that Daniel and Paul has been referring to. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. The exact same period of time that Daniel spoke of in chapter 7. Verse 25. So the last 3.5 years of the 7-year tribulation is when the Antichrist becomes indeed the Antichrist. The man of sin, the son of perdition. He's going to speak against God. The indignation is God's visitation of judgment on the Jews for their sins. Now that'll go on. This speaking against God, spoiling God's people until the time appointed. Of course, that'll be the fulfillment of the Antichrist's wicked course. You might ask me this morning, why is God going to allow the Jews to suffer so much? Why has he allowed them to suffer so much already? Why will he allow them to suffer more in the time of Jacob's trouble to prepare them to receive the Messiah, to get them ready to receive the Messiah, that they may be purged and purified? See, the purpose of the tribulation is not to purge and purify the church. No New Testament text says that. The only text they have is Old Testament text. And the context is not about the church, but about the Jews, Daniel's people. And never do they pertain to the Gentiles. Now let me leave a little thought or two here with you. Look there at the latter part of that 36th verse, and our time will be gone in just a few moments. For that that is determined shall be done. Now, have you ever heard anybody say that I believe what is to be will be? Well, I've said that, and you probably may have too. That may not be a very good saying. It might ought to be coined in a different fashion. We probably ought to say, what God has determined to come to pass will surely take place. That would probably be a more theologically, biblically correct statement to make, to say the least. But we certainly do have scripture there in verse 36 for the belief that what God has appointed, it will be done. Really, you know, there's just two ideas in the world. There is really just two religions. There's Arminianism, our sovereign grace doctrine. There's only just two. You say, well, there are thousands of religions, yes, but they're all after one kind or the other. They're all a chip off of the same block, or either they come off an entirely different block. There is the idea that man is his own savior. You can find that in Christendom, or you can find that in the heathen religions of the Orient. The idea is the same, though the teaching varies somewhat. And then also you can find that there are two ideas about how that the world is being run. And maybe you ought to say possibly almost three there. There were some heathens that believed in what was called fatalism. They believed that the world was governed by just a blind force of some sort, and that there was nothing in no intelligent being that directed the affairs of men. It just happened to be that way, and there was no other way that it could be. Well, that's really not the Christian view. That's not what we call divine providence. That's not what we call foreordination or the foreknowledge of God. We really believe that what God has determined to come to pass will surely come to pass. And so we ought to say it that way, but there's certainly scripture here for what is to be will be. And some people say, well, we don't want to believe that. Well, then I suppose you have an alternative. You can believe what is to be won't ever happen. Now think about that for a while. What is to be won't ever happen. What God wants to do, he can't do because the devil won't let him. So then you've got the devil being God, and God is no longer God. So I tell you, of the two ideas, it doesn't take me long to decide. I say that God is working all things after the counsel of his own will, and what he's determined, it will surely be done. You say, well, how do you know there's going to be a 7-year tribulation period in the future? God determined it. How do you know you're going to have this king of fierce countenance that's going to oppress the Jewish people and bring about the time of Jacob's trouble? God said it would be so. That's all I need to prove that it's going to be so. Just a few weeks ago, as I was reading over this, I noticed something in the verses to follow here, and I'm not going to go into that. I will just read it to you and let you think about it. It goes on describing him in verse 37 there, and it said, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. He won't pay any attention to the true God, nor the desire of women. You say, well, that means he wouldn't get excited about a woman of any kind. Could it be that he's a homosexual? That's the reason that he doesn't get excited about the women? Well, you think about that. That's a good one for you to think on for a while. We'll let that do it until next week. Good to have you in the class.